Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 977, Operation Mind Control, part 4, Subverting the Political Will, part 2. This is being recorded on September 5th of the year 2017. In recent months and again in weeks to come, we are going to be traversing the subject of political and mind control cults. We have been speaking about WikiLeaks and how it is really the opposite of the so-called progressive institution it has been made out to be. In Julian Assange's past is the Santa Ketamine Park Association, or the family. Not the opposition element it is represented as being, in my opinion, but in all probability the crucible in which Julian Assange, or Mendax the Liar, as he called himself, was formed. We have also spoken about Tulsi Gabbard and her association with a branch of the Hare Krishna cult, and also the Unification Church and the Japanese patriotic and ultra-nationalist societies. We're going to go back to very early 1985, and we're going to listen to some excerpts, December of 84 and January of 1985, and we're going to listen to excerpts of AFA program numbers 6 and 7 dealing with the unification, or dealing with Jonestown and the People's Temple. First off is a talk by Joe Holsinger, who was a legislative assistant to Representative Leo Ryan, who was killed at Port Kaituma Airstrip at Jonestown. Then we're going to listen to some discussion about a link between the investigation into Jonestown and the assassination of Martin Luther King, or cover-up thereof. And finally, we're going to take a look at some of the interesting links of the Layton family. Natalie Lawrence Layton Sr., former chief of chemical and biological warfare for the U.S. Army at Dugway Proving Ground, a member of the People's Temple, a person whose daughter-in-law and son were members of the cult, and someone who married into the Philip family. That was a German family that worked for IG Farben. That will wrap up the broadcast. And so we're going to go back again to December of 1984 and January of 1985 and listen to some information about the People's Temple and Jonestown. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, whose talents were fundamental to the realization of the archive shows.
Joe Holsinger.
If I had appeared on a public television several months ago with a group of black professionals, mostly psychologists and doctors, they invited me to appear today to provide information that they thought might be, that I might be able to help with this forum today, with their research. I appeared in Washington in February before the International Relations Committee and made some statements and some charges and documentation which resulted in the Foreign Affairs Committee, or International Relations Committee, whichever they call it today. They voted to ask the House Select Committee on Intelligence to investigate my charges, and they are currently investigating those charges by the House Select Committee on Intelligence.
Can you tell us what the charges are?
Well, the charges basically amounted to CIA contact with both the Burnham government there and with the People's Temple. That originally, it was my belief at the time I went to Washington that the purpose of our involvement there was to support the government of Burnham for commercial reasons, And they used the People's Temple almost as enforcers to help support an unpopular government there to keep control of the government of Guyana. We knew that there had been an article in the San Mateo Times in December of 79, which indicated that the deputy chief of mission there, Richard Dwyer, was in fact the CIA station chief. And he was the one that went to Jonestown with Leo's party, and he claimed to be slightly wounded, but there was a tape made at the time of the murders and suicides there with Jones yelling, "Get Dwyer out of here, get Dwyer out of here." And the indications are that it was Dwyer who went back into Jonestown after Leo was murdered and was there at the time. And there's great questions, just who shot Jim Jones and why, whether Jones was shot to shut him up. The question also as to how all these people died and just when they died, which is all documented here. But soon I came back from Washington because of my testimony. I started getting documentation from a Berkeley psychologist called the Penal Colony here and from the Alliance for Preservation of Religious Liberty in Washington, which indicated other things, one of which was that George Philip Blakey was a top Jones aide. And he was the man who arranged the purchase or the lease of the land in Guyana, provided the money and arranged the lease down there in 1974. He also was tracked now as being a CIA operative in Angola in 1975 with UNITA. He's also the same guy who was a top aide who arranged all this purchase and the finances, is also the husband of Deborah Leighton Blakey, who fled Jonestown and made those charges. He's a brother-in-law of Larry Leighton, who was acquitted yesterday. And it's interesting to note, the Peninsula Times Tribune says, yesterday, the jury acquitted, in acquitting Leighton, the jury appeared to have agreed with the defense contention that Leighton was brainwashed and drugged at the time of the shootings, could not be held criminally responsible. But the gist of what I'm getting to is this. I received a lot of documentation, which I will provide you to hear today, that indicates the strong possibility that Jonestown and the People's Temple was in reality a mass mind control experiment conducted by the CIA as a follow-up to something called MK Ultra, which they conducted from the early 50s through 1974. They used to use the VA hospital and state hospitals. They used the federal and state penitentiaries for their experiments.
Do you think that Jim Jones was actively involved with the CIA?
I do now.
Would you elaborate?
Let me read you one quotation. I read this at the end. It's a quotation from the book, The Strongest Poison. But we had reports before Lee went down to Guyana that Jones had given $1 million to Burnham. There was another connection was between Burnham and Jones. We thought it was based on money. We don't know where Jones got all that money. We know, for example, that Jones spent at least 9 months down in Brazil, I think it was. It was either in the late 60s or early 70s, after which he came back with the money to start the Mendocino operation of the People's Temple. And we're starting to have the linkage between, we have Blakey, who was his top assistant, one of his top assistants, over in Angola with the CIA. We have Dwyer down there, the station chief of CIA. They had a covert operation. They had to have a covert operation, which was not reported to Congress. Now, the Hughes-Ryan Act of 1974 said they had to report all CIA covert operations to the oversight committees. That was Leo's legislation. He co-authored that. There was no such report of a covert operation in Angola, in Guyana, meaning, I brought this out in Washington, one of the things they're checking into in Washington now, that the CIA broke the law if it had a covert operation or did not report it to these oversight committees. So what we have here is, Leo goes down there, and the question is, with Dwyer there, Dwyer came here from Thailand. He was with the CIA since 1959 in Guyana. We have photographs of Dwyer with his arms around Marceline Jones and Jim Jones out there. We have Dwyer going back to Jonestown after Leo's shooting, and Jones getting wiped out. And what we're trying to, we now have admission back with the Senate Intelligence Committee, for example, that they now admit that Dwyer was CIA and is CIA.
If Jonestown were...
What I'm doing is this. You're asking a question on CIA and the definite involvement. They always deny it. They denied that Dwyer was a CIA agent when I first charged it. They now admit it. They only admit what you can prove. We have here a copy of a document called Who's Who in the CIA, one of these attachments here, listing Dwyer as CIA since 1959 and where he's been.
Well, let me get back to my original question. I asked you, since you made the statement that you felt the CIA was using People's Temple as an experiment.
My question was,
was Jim Jones aware of it? Was he part of that experiment?
If that experiment existed, because I'm saying to you that this possibility is a strong possibility is raised. I'm inclined to believe it, I can't be sure, but I'm saying yes, that if such an experiment was there, Jones would have had to have been part of it and would have had to have led that experiment. Let me read to you this one statement from Jones, which is quoted in a guy, I hate to give you the source because it's the book The Strongest Poison by Mark Lane, and I know that Lane has lied in other parts of his book from personal experience. But there's a statement here, which you can read here, about Jones's claim that he was a true and loyal and patriotic American, if the terrible regime was obligated to remain in Guyana, and the world people would never know what a patriot he was. This is a statement from Jones, down in Jonestown. So what I would like to have you do, this is what I'm doing here, is very difficult for me to sort of shorthand this much documentation, but all I'm really doing is suggesting to you that I'm making this statement today to this forum. I've asked them to take the documentation I've attached, to consider going in and reviewing this data and conducting a further investigation on their own, especially in the black community, among survivors, among relatives of that, to see what elements they can find there, to either corroborate or disprove these statements about the mind control experiment in Jonestown.
Do you see any significance in the fact that Jones did his recruiting and had his temple in the black community insofar as an experimental situation that the CIA might have been involved in its concern?
I'm not sure that he started there deliberately. I think it's possible, more likely, that he had something going already at church going, and that if they were going to try to use cults or religious groups for this experimentation, they may have looked around for likely candidates who were already in action, already in operation. And they may look at somebody who was a charismatic leader type. And I don't think that he would started off this way. I think they may have watched his career and then decided to approach him. I think it would be more likely that he was already underway.
Do you have any conclusions as to how the people died in Jonestown?
Yes, I have part of our documentation here. Is a report from which is attached here. The chief medical examiner in Guyana is a Dr. Leslie Moto. He reported, and this is attached here, his opinion that more than 700... He based this on the injection marks in the upper arm. Page 4 of my statement here.
By injection, Linda?
Yes. And by gunfire. There were a lot more people killed by gunfire than they've ever admitted so far. We had heard reports that there were 50 of them, approximately 50 men with guns ringing around there so people couldn't get out. And very few of them did get out. According to the chief medical officer in Guyana, most of the people down there were murdered rather than suicide.
Who is suppressing all of this? Are you implying the CIA was active in the suppression?
Yes, I'm suggesting to you that a lot of things that don't make sense here. I'm suggesting that the long delay in anyone getting in, the press getting in there, or very many people at all getting in there for several days, was caused by a deliberate attempt to manufacture the story, which has now been accepted and sold successfully to the American people.
And what is that story that you think the people are falsely accepting?
That, in effect, this was a large group of disillusioned or disoriented black people who went down to Guyana and who turned their backs in this country and committed suicide, and we're rid of them, and that was just an aberration type of thing. I think that's the story that's been peddled. When you see the documentation here, you'll begin to wonder yourselves why the first reports were 350 people died or 400 people died, and for several days that was reported, and then they started finding more bodies. When the first reports were that 500 fled in the jungle, the people examined the bodies the first time and counted them by name, by types of people, men, women, and children, turned them over. Then a few days later, they claimed to have found two and three stacks of bodies underneath those. You know, it boggles the mind, the stories that were passed out, but they apparently have
gotten away with, I think, with one of the greatest fabrications of recent years.
And what do you think was really going on there?
You think is going on?
Whatever happened at Jonestown, I believe that our government, through the CIA, was in close touch with Jones before he left this country, that our government helped him to get established down there, ignored reports of brutality, ignored reports of guns being run down and drugs being sent down there, that our government used Jones, if nothing, at the minimum, to keep control of the government of Guyana for the prime minister we wanted down there. At the maximum, the possibility is that we may also have used it for a mass mind control experiment.
Do you think there is any connection between this surmise and the Larry Layton acquittal?
There is, but I can't quite figure out which it is. I never have figured that Larry Layton would ever be convicted of anything. He'll never be tried in this country. I think the long length of time it took to bring him to trial was so they could get everything in order, so they could arrange nothing to come out, as has happened. Now, whether Layton was the innocent victim and was a setup, or whether he was actually under drugs, as they say here in this article, I don't know. There's a report in what I have attached here that actually were blanks in his gun. He was waving a blank gun around and firing a blank gun. He may have been a setup. This thing is so weird. It's such a never-never world that I really can't... Except that I believe that our government worked with the government of Guyana to bring about an acquitted verdict down of Larry Layton. I don't think he'll ever be tried in this country for Leo's murder or for anything else.
What significance do you attach to the fact that the leadership of the temple was largely white and the membership of the temple was largely black?
I mentioned that in here. I think that that's part and parcel of the whole thing. I think that this is what caused me very suspicious about this whole experiment, about the possibilities here. The cadre was all white, and yet we think of Jonestown as a bunch of black people who were committed suicide without mentioning that white cadre, and that doesn't quite add up. I think there are racist overtones to the whole thing.
What kind of racist overtones? What are you exactly alleging here?
I'm alleging that the media picture that was printed, it was painted rather, and then brought out in print and so on, was that you don't have to worry about these people because they're crazy, they'll do anything, and they're not like us.
How far will the Congress take all of this?
I don't know. Bill Royer has been pushing hard on it. He's the man who was elected to take Leo's place, and he's been doing a good job. I now have Don Edwards interested and a few others back there interested, and they're starting to get interested because they're very busy, but all of a sudden they're starting to realize there's more to this. It's now before the Select Committee in the House. I don't expect much to come of that because they're very close to the CIA, but at least we're making some headway. We keep it going.
Do you feel threatened in as much as you're exposing the CIA here?
I don't know whether to feel threatened or not. If what I think is true, then possibly I'm in some danger, but except by getting it out in the open, I think that the danger to me, if there is any, would recede because that way I might become too visible if anything would happen. I might have an accident that, you know, I can't worry about that any more than Leo could worry about it. You have to just go ahead and do what you think is right.
Before Leo Ryan left for Jonestown on that trip, there had been a press conference three blocks from where we're sitting right now in the People's Temple, where Mark Lane and Marceline Jones had alleged that the CIA was engaged in a campaign to destabilize Jonestown, to invade it, to attack it, to destroy the social experiment that they portrayed Jonestown as having been. Were you, as Representative Ryan's aide and Representative Ryan himself, aware of those allegations? Did you lend any credence to them? Did you have any knowledge yourselves of possible CIA involvement in any way of this?
We had no knowledge or any thought of any CIA involvement. We knew the charges were being made. We deemed those to be Lane's charges to prevent Leo's trip, to prevent Leo from finding out what was actually the truth, whatever it was at Jonestown. And, however, we were mindful enough of it that Thursday night before Leo went down there, we had a meeting with Don Harris, the NBC TV crew, over at the airport's Hilton Hotel. And we discussed possible violence at Jonestown. And because of Mark Lane's charges that Leo's trip was going to be a CIA invasion, it was decided that evening by Leo and Don Harris and myself and others who were going, Bob Brown and others who were killed down there, that not to take any guns, including handguns, because any guns along might have meant that they could have claimed that provocation was started by the Ryan delegation. So it was decided not to take any guns, and that we did put enough credence in Lane's charges to try to defuse them so there would be no possibility of their being believed.
Do you have a theory about those 350 bodies and then the delay and then the 900? Did something happen between one wave of killings and the next?
I should preface this by saying that there can be 100 theories and then another 100 theories on top of it. The evidence or the statements here that are attached here seem to indicate the possibility that there was an attempt at suicide drills and suicide, you know, actual carrying out of the suicide, some of which worked and some of which didn't. That more than that, some of the people may have fled off into the jungle in sizable numbers trying to get away. And those people may have later been found and brought back and their bodies added to the original bodies.
Was there any autopsy results that might indicate time of death?
No, that's also attached here. No autopsies were performed, and we had, when our medical examiners went in, they did not perform autopsies, and that's one of the questions as to why not.
What was the drug experiment? Can you be more... trying to understand it here. MK, what was it called?
From 1953 to 1974, the CIA conducted experiments under something called MK Ultra program. You recall the LSD experiments in this country? People jumping out of windows, and the LSD experiments that George White, who was colonel of narcotics here, conducted around the country and around parts of the world. This was control of individuals, control of groups, control of whole populations. We have scientists in this country and elsewhere, including back in the Nazi Germany, that believe you can control behavior. It's shades of what they call the Brave New World. And there have been experiments in prisons, in hospitals, along those lines. But this is what they were doing, okay?
Is that not called lithium, the drug?
Well, that was one of the several. I have a whole list of drugs that were used as experiments here. So by 1974, the American Civil Liberties Union and other groups and lawsuits had forced the government to stop these programs using prisons and hospitals. And Helms, then the director of the CIA, said that they had lost interest in mine because they were terminating it. The charge attached here is, and the things that I received, was they then went over into the private sector and started going into the matter of cults and religious groups and conducting their experiments there.
Does MK have any significance?
I don't know what the initials stand for. It's MK Ultra, and I know that people in Washington are very familiar with the big. Before that, they had something called Operation Artichoke, which included killing a prominent American politician, just as an experiment. Something called COINTELPRO, and others.
Any evidence, documentation, notes, somebody keeping notes on the results of the test?
Yes. They have some of the. We have attached here some of those photocopies, some of those results that they were gotten under Freedom of Information Act. And so I think when you read the, especially the one from the penal colony and the one from the Associate Preservation of Religious Liberty, you'll see the reason why I felt moved to do something. I should say that I first heard his reports right after the tragedy in Guyana, within a few months, and I disbelieved them. I just thought it was ridiculous, and for a year I paid no attention to it until then I heard about the wire being down there and going back in and realized it was a covert operation. Then I testified in Washington in February, and then I got this material. I've only been on this trail for 2 months now, but it's all come because of my testimony in Washington. The other things were starting to, the more we talk, the more we find out, the more information comes to us. I'm here today to ask the help of this group, this Black Professional Leadership Group, and they're asked for their assistance in finding out more.
What is their reaction?
I'd say it was a mixed reaction. Some of them were suspicious that I was who I was. Was I really trying to divert attention, you see, from what the reality was? I think they were receptive, and I think they're going to go along and decide.
When you say divert from the reality, what do you mean?
Well, they were concerned that I was trying to maybe suggest a CIA plot just to, there might be some other truth to it, and that I was sent here to divert attention from whatever reality it might be.
Would you be kind enough to summarize what you think was being done to the People's Temple people through the CIA? You started to say use of drugs, but what do you think really happened down there in the way of the mind control?
I think they were conducting
You know, I really believe that there's a strong possibility. I'll have to put it this way, without being able to prove it. It's my impression at this time that they were conducting some sort of mind control experiments. For example, they had a very modern hospital down there, which they bragged about. So modern that in that population, they had medical checkups for everyone every day. So there's no need for that unless you're conducting experiments where you're having control groups and you're giving people, and they gave them their, they're giving their vitamins every day. And it's my guess that they were just using them as guinea pigs to see what they could do under isolated circumstances. They'd take them off into a jungle someplace far away from everybody. They get them there somehow, and then they're able to see how these various drugs work on different groups. Because of the medical checkups every day and the large number of drugs that I found down there, I'm inclined to believe that there was a mind control experimentation going on. And because of the links we now have through Dwyer and through Philip Blakey, I'm inclined to see some CIA involvement there. Whether that adds up to a full-scale government program of mind control, I do not know. But there's enough there that it needs to be investigated thoroughly.
What are the implications for other cults and organizations that we now have here in Northern California, such as, for example, the Moonies? We just had a national leader elected of the Moonies, the Hare Krishnas in Berkeley, who it turns out have submachine guns, and other organizations like that. Do you think there's a possibility that there's some relationship between the kind of things going on that?
These documents claim that. Just a moment, please.
I have an extra copy if you want.
Thank you. Yes, the statements are made in here that the Korean CIA, they tab as the money source for the Moonies, for the Reverend Sung Young Moon. They talk about Sinanon and some of Sinanon's experimentation. Now, whether or not this is part and parcel, they question Moonies, they question Sinanon, they question the great growth of the cult movement in the early 70s, about the time they were swinging away, well, I thought they were closing down, supposedly, the CIA MK Ultra program.
So what are you doing now?
Real estate development. Industrial real estate development. Yeah.
What exactly are the reasons that you think that Layton, that you expected Layton to be acquitted?
Well, primarily that as a surviving member of the People's Temple and somebody that he was dangerous to the authorities. If he did know anything and talked on the grounds that they were going to, if they were going to execute him or put him long term in prison, he just might talk to get even or to prevent being sent to prison or being executed. So I think that Layton, for two reasons. One is Layton Newt may have known too much, and besides that, you find that his father, I'd like to give you this one at this time, just as a little follow up. Philip Blakey was his brother-in-law. His father is Dr. Lawrence Layton. And Dr. Lawrence Layton is former chief of biochemistry and director of chemical warfare at the U.S. Army Dugway Proving Ground in Utah in the early 1950s. More recently, Dr. Layton has worked as a research scientist at the Western Regional Research Laboratory for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Berkeley, California. So you're tying Dr. Layton is chief of biochemistry and director of chemical warfare for the United States Army at a time that we had MK Ultra being started.
But then you said earlier that you thought Layton might have been under drugs and he might have had blanks in his gun. Would they have done that with his father?
They the blanks in the gun would fit there because then it could prove he didn't fire anything, right?
But what about him being on drugs and then experiments?
I don't know. I'm only postulating here. I'm only guessing. But, you know, what's interesting to me is the way that this Layton Blakey family is so tied into everything. And when you have key operatives, if you do have operatives, they have to be pretty tightly held, your key people.
Do you have any theories about Tim and Grace Stone that fit into this at all?
I don't know about Tim Stone. I know that Tim was, I saw a picture of Tim as a young man picked up in East Germany, in East Berlin, back in the mid-50s, as a student back there. Then he came back here and he gave up his Porsche and he gave up his good job and he went and joined Jim Jones. And the big fight that supposedly caused this, was given as a reason for the blow-up at Jonestown, was over this, whose son it was and all. So I'm getting to the point where I can't really tell legitimate, as I say in here, legitimate suspicion from paranoia. So you start looking at everybody and wondering, and I just don't know.
Thank you.
Now, Mark Lane was at this time an attorney representing People's Temple. He also, at the time of the Jonestown Massacre, was representing James Earl Ray when the House Select Committee on Assassinations was holding hearings into the assassinations of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. On November 18, 1978, when the massacre happened, the House Select Committee was in the middle of hearing the testimony vis-a-vis the assassination of Martin Luther King, okay? And the Friday, as a matter of fact, before the Saturday of the massacre, a former FBI agent named Murtaugh, who had been stationed in the Atlanta FBI office, testified that when word came through that Dr. King had been shot, there was jubilation in the Atlanta FBI office, and that later on, that there was more jubilation when they heard he'd died. He talked about FBI harassment of King and of attempts to get Martin Luther King to commit suicide, and actually broke up in tears in the middle of the public hearings. That was one of the most dramatic moments in all of the hearings. Of course, Mark Lane had been going on all sorts of stations, notably KGO here in the Bay Area, saying that Jonestown was a paradise on earth and so forth. And of course, he was saying that the government killed Martin Luther King and that James Earl Ray was innocent. Not only did Jonestown overshadow the Martin Luther King hearings, but after that, Mark Lane looks like God's own fool after he is told so that People's Temple is a paradise on earth. It turned out to be a hell on earth, and so by implication he makes James Earl Ray claim of innocence look bad. Now, Mark Lane, in his role as People's Temple attorney, had arranged for Grace Walden, or Grace Stevens, to go down on the passport of a woman who had been killed in an automobile accident to Jonestown. Had he been successful in doing that, she basically would have been at the Jonestown massacre and the main witness in refuting the only witness to link James Earl Ray to the rooming house from which he allegedly shot Dr. King would have been gone with the wind. Well, one of the theories that has been advanced, and there's a great deal of evidence to support it at this point, is that Jim Jones' agenda was essentially drawn up for him by one aspect or another of the U.S. national security establishment. A number of different federal agencies and organizations have been connected in one way or another with Jonestown, notably the Central Intelligence Agency, and also perhaps also the United States Army and some of its most prestigious and strategic research facilities. Specifically, as far as CIA goes, some of the names you want to know are George Philip Blakey, who essentially was a fellow who had worked for the Central Intelligence Agency in Angola on behalf of the UNITAL organization in Angola. Now, George Philip Blakey put down the original $650,000 down deposit on the territory of the People's Temple in Guyana. Okay, now this fellow, George Philip Blakey, is married to a woman named Debbie Layton Blakey. Now, Debbie Layton Blakey is the brother of Larry Layton Jr. Larry Layton was the fellow who allegedly led the Port Kaituma firing squad, which executed former U.S. Congressman Leo Ryan and a number of other people. Now, his father, Lawrence Layton Sr., as well as his mother, Lisa Layton, were members of the People's Temple also. Now, Larry Layton Sr., George Philip Blakey is married to Debbie Layton Blakey, the brother of Larry Layton or Lawrence Layton Jr. Okay, George Philip Blakey works for CIA and UNITA. Also present at the massacre, the Jonestown Massacre, was a fellow named Richard Dwyer, who was CIA Chief of Mission in Guyana. And on that famous tape of Jim Jones exhorting his followers during the massacre, he can be heard, Jim Jones that is, can be heard saying, "Get Dwyer out of here." Okay? Now, Lawrence Layton Sr., the father of Larry Layton Jr. and Debbie Layton Blakey, he's a very interesting fellow, and we're going to talk about him in just a minute. Among the many things that he was involved with was he was in charge of research and development for the U.S. Army's Chemical and Biological Warfare Program at the Dugway Proving Grounds in Utah. Now, an interesting thing about Congressman Leo Ryan was that he was the co-author of the Hughes-Ryan Amendment, and what that had done was to oblige the Central Intelligence Agency to give Congress prior notification of impending covert action. And that amendment brought the Angola operation on behalf of UNITA to a halt. And of course, and recall that George Philip Blakey was part of that operation. There's also an interesting connection to Jonestown. A woman who basically was killed in a very suspicious automobile accident had her passport given to the only witness to link James, well, basically a witness who could discredit the only witness to link James Earl Ray to the place where he supposedly assassinated Martin Luther King from. And that woman would have been down. Her name was Grace Stevens, or Grace Walden, depending on whether you use her married name. She was a common law wife of Charles Q. Stevens, the only person to link James Earl Ray to the place where he supposedly assassinated Martin Luther King. Worth noting also that the Jonestown massacre totally diverted attention away from the House Select Committee on Assassinations hearings about Jonestown. Okay, so these are some of the intelligence connections with regard to Jonestown. There are others, and we speculated about the possibility of a connection between a project to experiment and use psychosurgery on prisoners at Nike missile sites in Southern California. It was basically to an institute to be set up in conjunction with UCLA for the study and prevention of violent behavior, and we speculated that perhaps that had the frustration of that project had given rise to Jonestown. And again, Niptuck referred to Mae Brussel, whose work is carried twice a week on the station, Sunday mornings at 10 and Wednesday evenings at 10. And Mae was not only the first person to talk about mind control, but was the first person also to break the Jonestown connection. And she also did a lot of work on the proposed UCLA Institute for the Study and Prevention of Violent Behavior. Now, the Layton family, as I said, is a very, very interesting bunch of people. And we're going to cover some of the connections of Lawrence Layton Sr. Now recall how involved the Laytons were with Jonestown. Larry Layton Jr. leads the Port Kaituma Airstrip Massacre, which kills Leo Ryan, among others. His sister is married to George Philip Blakey, the CIA agent who put down the original down payment on Jonestown, on the Guiana property down there. And the mother, Lisa Layton, is also a member of People's Temple. And the father, Lawrence Layton Sr., was a member of People's Temple and is perhaps the single most important figure in this entire story. Now, in just a second, Niptuck's going to read you an interesting piece of background about Lawrence Layton Sr. It's going to come from an interesting book called In My Father's House. Now, this is the story of the Layton family and the Reverend Jim Jones. It has two authors, Min S. Yee, and Thomas N. Layton, L-A-Y-T-O-N, who is the son of Lawrence Layton Sr., the brother of Larry Layton Jr. Okay? And this book was published in softcover by Berkeley Books and was copyrighted in... Copyrighted 1981, okay? Min Yee, Thomas Layton, In My Father's House.
Okay, now the first is a very short segment. The significance of this, at least the possible significance of this, will be explained in a moment. The family they're going to refer to is the Philip family. Now the Philip family, Philip is the maiden name of Lisa Layton, the wife of Lawrence Layton Sr., the mother of Debbie Layton Blakey and Lawrence Layton Jr.
So this is the wife's family we're talking about right here, the woman who marries Dr. Lawrence Layton Sr., the father of all the Laytons, and this is the Philip family, the maiden name of Lisa Layton.
Right. Now, the family was, at the time that they're speaking about, was living, I believe, in Hamburg, Germany, and they say financially, again, in the book In My Father's House, financially, however, the 1920s were good to the Philip family. Again, this is the family of Larry Layton Jr.'s mother's parents. As a stockbroker, Hugo, the mother's father, represented such firms as I.G. Farben and the chemical giant Siemens and Halske. His banking business also flourished, and the family lived well. Now, in and of itself, a fairly innocuous paragraph. The interesting thing, of course, being this early connection with the I.G. Farben chemical combine. Those of you who have listened to some of our other Radio Free America broadcasts, the early ones on the foundations of the Cold War, or Uncle Sam and the Swastika, or some of the other shows dealing with industrialism in the Third Reich, will realize the possible significance of this. I.G. Farben was the German chemical combine that crops up all over the place in the study of post-World War II anti-communism, and even pre-World War II anti-communism and support of fascism. The international combine known as I.G. Farben, originally a chemical dyestuff combine, later went into the makings of things such as Zyklon B nerve gas used in the execution chambers of the concentration camps, and a variety of other things that were used by the German army to fight with and by the German economy to support the German army. I.G. Farben also was very heavily involved with numerous Western industrial powers, such as Standard Oil, and in many cases, this involvement continued right through the war. In many cases, raising some doubts about the relative loyalty of the Western industrial powers that were indeed still dealing with IG Farben and were laying open their technical secrets for some rather important things during time of war, such as how to make artificial rubber and things like this, which would be of infinite value to a war effort, especially for Germany, which had no access for most of the war to rubber supplies. Now, the other interesting thing about IG Farben is that by the end of the war, when the IG Farben cartel was more or less broken up, again, as we see so often in these cases, it was not fully broken up, and many parts of it still survive today, such as the Bayer people who make Bayer aspirin, or GAF that make GAF floor tiles, and the GAF Viewmaster that Henry Fonda used to advertise. But although the combine was broken up slightly, the more interesting fact is that several of the important, I suppose the board members and the directors of IG Farben, actually stood trial for war crimes, among the only civilians ever to stand trial for war crimes and be convicted. We've mentioned Otto Ambrose a great deal because he just recently came back into the United States at the express behest of a personal friend of President Reagan's, also well-known industrialist who crops up in these things. But so IG Farben was very, very deeply sunken in the business of the Third Reich and was involved in all aspects of the war effort.
Not only that, but it's worth noting that IG Farben, like so many of the key German defense industries and cartels, was very much connected with American business. The Dulles Brothers law firm, the prestigious law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, a top Wall Street law firm, handled the legal business of the American subsidiary of IG Farben. IG was a cartel, it was an international monopoly, and had profound and ongoing connections with American business, and it was part of that German-American industrial axis that we've spoken about a great deal on this broadcast and our Uncle Sam on the station and our Uncle Sam on the Swastika broadcast. If anybody would like to know more about that, that also is on file, and if somebody would like a copy of that program, they can contact us after the show here.
Okay, so the basic summation then. Again, many of these things at this point crop up only as circumstantial ties, and it is, of course, up to you folks to decide whether there's anything there besides mere circumstance, but we find the mother of Larry Layton and Debbie Layton Blakey coming from a family, where the father worked actively for IG Farben. Of course, IG Farben was a big corporation, but as a big corporation, nonetheless, it still managed to get involved in a lot of nasty things, and that is the first thing to look at in terms of the Layton family.
It's also worth noting that all of the cults or alleged cults that we're going to be dealing with on this broadcast have evidentiary tributaries or connecting links to various aspects of the Axis, of the Japanese, German, and Italian alliance during the Second World War. And they are, this is one of the interesting aspects of these various cults, their intelligence connections, their fascist connections and overtones. These are the things we're going to be looking at the program tonight. And the German origins of Lisa Philipp, now Lisa Layton, or I guess Lisa Layton when she passed away, are not incidental. It's worth noting that Lisa was introduced to her husband, Lawrence Layton Sr., or Lawrence as we'll call him here, by the fellow who she had been dating in Germany, and the same fellow, a German fellow who had also come to the United States, introduced her, well, actually met her when she got off the boat from Germany, and then it was this same fellow who introduced her to Lawrence Layton Sr. And this, so it's an interesting tangle of people, and how coincidental some of this is, well, perhaps you can decide for yourselves, and if we have time for phone-ins at the end, you can perhaps comment on that. And there's an interesting piece of background concerning Lawrence Layton Sr. and his connection to the Philip family, or elements thereof, is also brought out in My Father's House. Reading. Lawrence was preparing for his doctoral examinations when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. Fearing that Lawrence would be drafted, Lisa wrote to her father's cousin, Dr. James Franck, F-R-A-N-C-K, the Nobel laureate who was now professor of physics at the University of Chicago. Dr. Franck arranged a pre-doctoral appointment in physics for Layton at Chicago. But then Layton received a student deferment, and he decided to finish his doctoral work at Pennsylvania. If he had gone to Chicago, he discovered later, he would have been working on the Manhattan Project, developing the first atomic bomb. Lisa was horrified when she first learned this. Now, remember Dr. James Franck, the cousin of Lisa Philipp, later Lisa Layton, and his role in looking for a job for Lawrence Layton. Initially, he was going to go out to Chicago, at the University of Chicago, where he would have been working on the Manhattan Project, the first atomic bomb. Remember that as you listen to the following information.
Yes, it seems that Lawrence Layton was not to avoid the atomic bomb, no matter how hard he tried. Again, from my father's house, continuing a little later on in the story, Layton was also having his troubles at work. It turned out that his boss at Kodak, Dr. Hickman, was interested in ideas that came from one source only, himself. Layton was coming up with too many suggestions that Hickman thought crossed over into his own private reserve. One sketch sheet that Layton turned in had to do with thermal diffusion in the purification of chemicals. Layton didn't know it at the time, but the Manhattan Project had already been set up, and Kodak was involved in it, using a similar process in purifying uranium isotopes at its plant in the remote town of Kingsport, Tennessee. So again, according to the book, that Layton was not aware of it, but Kodak was indeed working on the Manhattan Project, and Layton appeared to be doing some work that fairly closely paralleled some activity that Kodak was involved in for the Manhattan Project.
So remember the Manhattan Project connection. Perhaps Lawrence Layton was not working on it, or perhaps there was an aspect of the project that he was working on with or without his knowledge. It says in this book that he was not aware of the Manhattan Project, although there's a lot of good information in the book. It is written by a member of the Layton family and is reasonably self-serving. Perhaps nothing more than an interesting coincidence, the fact that initially Lawrence Layton was to go out to Chicago, where his wife's cousin was going to get him a job on the Manhattan Project. Later, he goes back east to Eastman Kodak, where he's working on, among other things, a chemical diffusion process, which was something very similar to, which, if not identical to, was in fact being used on the Manhattan Project.
One of the reasons that, again, in most cases one would say, well, simply a coincidence, not only the hindsight of what later happened to the Layton family causes us to scrutinize this a little more closely, but the fact that within 5 years or so, 5 or 6 years after the end of World War II, Lawrence Layton Sr. would find himself in a very, very prominent position in a rather interesting part of the defense establishment, and later on would also find himself moved to a high position in another part of the defense establishment, and he certainly seemed to have quite a bit of clout for a young man who had been working all unawares for Kodak during World War II without having any connections to any of these people, as we will see.
Good point. Again, this is a speculative note, but very important perhaps in light of Lawrence Layton's later career, because Lawrence Layton has many, many connections which go to the innermost sanctums of the national security establishment. Perhaps his most significant appointment for our case, for our purposes here, was when he was named basically chief of research for the biochemistry branch of the Chemical Warfare Division of the U.S. Army at Dugway Proving Ground. Okay? This is mentioned in my father's house. It reads as follows. Between the Dugway Mountains and the Stansbury Range, 80 miles southwest of Salt Lake City, lies the Dugway Proving Grounds. Like more than half of Utah, the area in prehistoric times was covered by Lake Bonneville. Now the flat, dry lake bed encompasses thousands of square miles. During World War II, Dugway was the testing site for various types of incendiary weapons. Field and laboratory tests of toxic gases and chemicals were also conducted there. When Lawrence Layton arrived at Dugway in the fall of 1951, his title was Chief Biochemistry Branch Chemical Warfare Division. As the chief, he directed the work of 8 other chemists and biochemists, a team that performed toxicological and pharmacological investigations of various toxic agents and how these agents affected animals in field tests. The research team also studied the effects of various chemical warfare agents on blood and nerve enzymes. All their work was classified secret or top secret. Remember the work on people and the work studying the effects of various chemicals and toxic agents. 4 months after his arrival, Layton's responsibilities expanded greatly when he was named chief of the entire Chemical Warfare Division. By the spring of 1952, he was directing all the activities of the division, including the research, development, and testing of all chemical items and toxic agents by the division's 5 branches: analytical chemistry, biological chemistry, organic chemistry, physical chemistry, and the field test branch. According to an unclassified government report, he, quote, was responsible for the publication of 10 classified reports on research aspects of chemical warfare agents and more than 100 reports on chemical weapons systems. So this is a very, very, very important appointment for our purposes here. Perhaps ironic, too, in light of his in-laws' connections to IG Farben, which developed so many of the modern poison gases, including nerve gas, and it's something that should definitely be kept in mind in light of some of the information that we're going to be covering later. So again, remember the connections to the Manhattan Project as you observe the progress of Lawrence Layton up as he moves his way on up through the U.S. National Security Establishment. Here, again, chief of the entire Chemical Warfare Division. Okay, and remember his work testing chemical agents and biological warfare agents.
Okay, now, usually when people in whatever kind of establishment, a business establishment or otherwise, they move, they either usually, if they move horizontally, it's usually they move to a different group of people but doing the same kind of thing, or else occasionally if they move to a new discipline, they will start over again a little lower down. However, Lawrence Layton Sr. seems to have been moved to another position of extreme responsibility in a field he was not very familiar with. Reading again from In My Father's House, after almost 2 years at Dugway, Layton decided he had had enough of the proving grounds. For one thing, he could not bring himself to participate in the cliquish backbiting and politicking that went on there. He felt that the post commander was, quote, the most disgusting and arrogant and profane person I'd ever met, unquote. Layton wanted no part of the professional jealousy and paranoia of his colleagues. When a friend from Washington, D.C. visited the Dugway facility, Layton confided his unhappiness, and the friend suggested that he apply for an opening at the Naval Powder Factory, later more accurately named Propellant Facility, at Indian Head, Maryland. Layton arranged for an interview, put in for some vacation time, took a train to Washington, and was immediately offered a job as Associate Director of Research and Development. He didn't feel fully qualified for the position, but working with ballistics, rockets, ICBMs, and the new Vanguard satellite program seemed an interesting challenge. Also, he would be leaving behind the unhealthy politicking at Dugway, and his family would be happy with a move back to Maryland. Okay, so apparently the unhealthy politicking which surrounded him despite the fact that he was basically in charge of the chemical division drove him out of the Dugway Proving Grounds, and he managed to walk into a job as an associate director of research at the Propellant Facility at Indian Head, Maryland, again working right squarely, and this is a man who during World War II was essentially an apprentice working for Kodak, and 7, 8, 9 years after World War II he's already become head of chemical warfare research and then an associate director of research for IBM's, ICBM's ballistic missiles, rockets, and the Vanguard satellite program. So a man who definitely has a rising star.
Alrighty, now recall that in the first program that we dealt with Jones, and in the second part of our series about mind control, we examined the possibility that Jonestown may have been an extension of some of the CIA and military's mind control programs. Here, what we're really asking you to consider is simply some of the contradictions in the official story of Jonestown, in particular, the official story with regard to the bodies. Initially, there were reports of 1,100 passports of People's Temple members who went down to Jonestown. Then about 150 to 200 of them simply vanished from the news. All of a sudden, they began talking about 900. For the first 5 days or so of the after the massacre, the press reports simply talked about 400 bodies. After about 5 days of looking for the other missing 500 people, no word about the 200 who were lopped off at the beginning, all of a sudden, the press reported that, by golly, here were the other 500 bodies. They were under the first 400 all along, and they just hadn't noticed it. They said there were a great many children who were had been murdered and were lying underneath the bodies. This in spite of the fact that the bodies had been were in the process of being turned over and identified to the extent that they could this entire time. Now that this is one of the aspects of the Jonestown situation that has elicited a great deal of curiosity from people in the past. A lot of people have expressed grave reservations as to how that could possibly have happened. Now remember Lawrence Layton Sr.'s work in testing chemical and biological agents at the Dugway Proving Grounds in Utah. And think about some of the anomalies in the official story. I'd like to read you a short section now from a book called The Children of Jonestown. That was authored by Kenneth Wooden, W-O-O-D-E-N, published in softcover by McGraw-Hill and copyrighted 1981. Wooden's also the author of a very famous book about disturbed orphans and attempts to find foster homes for them called Weeping in the Playtime of Others. And Wooden did some work about the many children who were at Jonestown, and I'd like to read you a short section of that here. Wooden writes in The Children of Jonestown, "Initially, the United States and Guyana agreed that the 400 known bodies were to be buried at Jonestown. But as the body count rose day by day, so did Prime Minister Burnham's concern that his country would become a cult shrine. He told the U.S. Embassy that the dead Americans had to be removed at once. The United States military was quickly mobilized, and within several days of Dr. Moto's arrival, he was the chief medical examiner of Guyana, was on the scene to start the grim task of removing the bodies. The first chore of the troops was to bayonet the bloated bodies to release the internal gases caused by the hot sun and high humidity. The second was more controversial. Although Ordell Rhodes and Stanley Clayton had returned to the compound the first morning to help identify the dead, quote, on orders from very high up, all politically sensitive papers and forms of identification were removed from the corpses." I'm going to read that sentence again. "Although Ordell Rhodes and Stanley Clayton had returned to the compound the first morning to help identify the dead, quote, on orders from very high up, all politically sensitive papers and forms of identification were removed from the corpses," unquote. Photos on the cover of Newsweek and other magazines and newspapers clearly show that many of the bodies had ID tags on them. Joel Cobb and John Stone, who are now among the unidentified children, were initially positively identified. Jim Cobb told NBC News in March of 1979, quote, "My brother, Johnny Cobb, saw tags on the people's bodies, and only two members of my family have been identified, and I want to know why," unquote. Lieutenant General Gordon Sumner later was reported to have said, quote, "It was the first time in his military career that he saw his men politicized," unquote. In view of the fact that the order to strip the IDs came from Robert Pastor, P-A-S-T-O-R, of the staff of Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter's national security advisor, it is clear that the impulse was to save any possible embarrassment to the Carter administration. This action would, in many cases, make the process of identification impossible for the medical authorities in Guyana, and once the bodies had been returned to the United States. Dr. Rudiger Breitenecker, B-R-E-I-T-E-N-E-C-K-E-R, a Baltimore pathologist, said that the seven autopsies of which at which he assisted, quote, were severely hampered by lack of crucial information, which is usually collected in medical legal investigations, unquote. Unaware of the stripping of the bodies and uninformed of Dr. Moto's work and findings, the United States pathologists naively told the New York Times on February 18, 1979, quote, "We shuddered about the degree of ineptness," unquote. Preparing the children for removal from Jonestown to the United States was no easy task for the GIs assigned to the duty. In fact, the Army and Air Force are quietly providing psychiatric help to many of the young soldiers and airmen who assisted in the removal of the bodies from Jonestown. Well, there's a lot of things to mention in this passage I just read. First of all, why would the ID tags be cut off the bodies? In particular, why would the orders come down from a top advisor on the staff of Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter's national security advisor, to remove the body, remove the tags from the bodies? And indeed, then, what is the, you know, how can you account for the discrepancy in the casualty figures reported from Jonestown? It seems unlikely that 500 bodies could have been hidden under the first 400 all along while people were attempting to identify them. And the question is, was there any relation, this is simply speculation, was there any relationship between some of the types of work that Dr. Lawrence Layton in the past was doing and Jonestown? Were these people in any way being used for experimentation? Was this a form of covert operation? And again, remember Dr. Lawrence Layton's work testing toxins at Dugway Proving Ground. Remember the connections to I.G. Farben, and remember Dr. Lawrence Layton's many, many connections to various aspects of the U.S. national security establishment. Again, we're not saying that we have the absolute answer here. What we're saying is that the facts as they are given are not only don't make sense, but are in all probability impossible, and that something appears to be rotten in Denmark, and we're saying what, where, and why were the ID tags cut off.
One also wants to at least raise an eyebrow and look curiously at the Army and Air Force psychiatrists that have been brought in to help the soldiers who were involved in stripping the ID tags and so hopelessly confusing the identification that to this day, as far as I know, quite a few bodies remain unidentified from Jonestown. What kind of psychiatric help they're getting? Of course, one of the results of the stripping of the identification from these bodies and some of the other things that have gone on is that to this day nobody has been able to develop any kind of a clear picture of who was where when, which of course when you're trying to put together information on this kind of scene afterwards is the kind of thing that's vitally important to get timelines going, positioning, and to show the ebb and flow of people in and out of the Jonestown compound in the first place. So basically what has been done by the removal of those ID tags, not just to render the bodies of the people who died at Jonestown nameless, but in many cases also to so completely confuse any investigation that might go on as to make it virtually impossible to put anything concrete together.
A couple of quick points. Now, remember, we've come across Zbigniew Brzezinski in the past. He is a Polish native who was a professor at Columbia University in New York. He then went on to become President Carter's National Security Advisor. Now, in our Radio Free America show about Reinhard Galen, the Nazi intelligence chief who jumped to the United States with his entire Eastern Front and organization, we took a look at the curious circumstances by which a fellow named Valerian Trifa, a Galen agent, a Romanian Nazi, a war criminal, came to speak over the Romanian language service of Radio Free Europe on May Day of 1979, and we took a look at the fact that his hiring by Radio Free Europe and the subsequent firing of employees who were critical of this Nazis being hired to address Romania were basically the people responsible for hiring Trifa were part of a circle of friends which included Zbigniew Brzezinski, the key names there, Noel Bernard, head of the Romanian language service, and a fellow named Paul Henze, longtime CIA operative, former colleague of Brzezinski's at Radio Free Europe, which recall was started by Reinhard Galen. We mentioned that in our Radio Free America series about Galen. And it's worth noting that Henze has been very active with the thesis, been in publicizing the assertion that the KGB shot the Pope, which we've devoted a major block of time here on KFJC to putting it down. One last note here before we leave the People's Temple, and I would say you can probably figure at some point we'll do an entire Radio Free America show about the People's Temple, because they're tremendous, it's a tremendous issue, and we haven't covered all of it. If you think that all of our speculation about the Leighton family possibly being involved in some sort of intrigue or skullduggery is pure poppycock, take note of this particular incident in the Leighton family shortly after Lawrence Leighton received his appointment to Dugway. Again, reading from In My Father's House. On May 10th, 1952, just 2 months after Leighton was named chief of the Chemical Warfare Division, Anita Phillip, that's the mother of Lisa Leighton, Anita Phillip committed suicide by jumping from the window of her New York apartment. The suicide note she left behind was written in German and translates roughly as follows. Quote, "My friends, know that I, free and proper, am a good American, but I was a gossip and have been entangled in a network of intrigue. I no longer have the strength to free myself from it. Forget me not, my beloved children and family, and you, Hugo, forgive me." Hugo, recall, is the father of Lisa Leighton, the lawyer for I.G. Farben. "Live well. All of you loved mankind so well." She signed the note with a single letter A. She was 61 years old. So apparently somebody was noting a pattern of intrigue involving the Leighton Phillip axis some time before. So again, if this seems a little far-fetched to you, if it seems like we're clutching at straws, well, apparently that was more than Anita Phillip had to clutch as she fell from that window.
Again, some of the many intelligence and national security connections to the Jonestown operation, which may very well have been an extension of the mind control programs that various intelligence services engaged in. And this as by way of providing some background to subjects that we have spoken of recently and that we will be speaking of again. This concludes For the Record program number 977, Operation Mind Control Part 4, Subverting the Political Will Part 2. This is being recorded on September 5th, 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.